And this is KPCW. Good morning. It's 8:06. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta, filling in for Roger Goldman on this Friday, September 12th. Currently sitting around 42 degrees and partly cloudy here in Old Town Park City. Over in the Heber Valley, just a tad warmer, around 46. Looking at mostly cloudy skies today with a chance of showers. Afternoon, around a 50% chance in the Wasatch Back. Expecting highs today of 72 in Park City and 76 in Heber. We'll drop down tonight to 45 in Park City and potentially the 38, getting down into the 30s in the Heber Valley. Looking at tomorrow, expecting high of 68 in Park City and 73 in Heber with a slight chance of shower and thunderstorms throughout the day. And then Sunday is looking lovely, a high of 72, sunny in Park City, and a high of 76 over in the Heber Valley. No meteorologist weather report today, not seeing any crashes to report on area roadways either. Coming up, Park City High School social studies teacher Joanna Andres joins us after being named Utah's Teacher of the Year. Then the U.S. Forest Service's Brenda Bushell updates us on Summit County's Beulah Fire and the status of Utah's wildfire season. And Wasatch Community Foundation's Bruce Wardle shares details about the organization's 25th anniversary celebration. Plus, KPCW's own Sarah Urban has big news on KPCW's Summer Pledge Drive and how you can support the station this weekend. The Utah Supreme Court says it will hear the lawsuit over the future of an LDS temple in the Heber Valley. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has this update.
The state Supreme Court's decision Wednesday to retain the case is the latest development in the legal battle among Wasatch County, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and four Heber residents. The case began in 4th District Court soon after the Wasatch County Council approved the temple plans in November 2023. The residents, who live in the Red Ledges neighborhood across the street from the temple site, argued the county acted illegally by using a legislative development agreement to approve the plans. In July, 4th District Judge Jennifer Mabee ruled in favor of the county and the church, but residents appealed her decision in short order. The resident's attorney, Robert Mansfield, said in an email he was pleased the Supreme Court chose to take up the appeal, saying it would likely lead to a faster resolution. In a letter asking the court to retain the case, Mansfield wrote the appeal could set a precedent for how local governments apply Utah's county land use laws, known as CLEDMA, an issue that was at the heart of the residents' challenge. Deputy Wasatch County Attorney John Woodard agreed the appeal could have implications for many other land use lawsuits across the state. Attorneys for the church were equivocal in their brief comments to the court. They said they disagreed with Mansfield's arguments. They wrote, quote, "The church does not object to the Utah Supreme Court retaining jurisdiction over this matter if it so chooses." No dates for Supreme Court proceedings had been set as of Thursday. Meanwhile, the parties are still arguing at the district court level too. After the church commenced construction on the 18-acre temple site along Center Street, the residents filed a motion to stay, asking the court to prohibit further work on the temple until the appeal process is complete. A hearing for that request is scheduled for September 18th. The Heber Valley Temple plans call for an 88,000 square foot building with a 210-foot steeple. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
And the central sign on a historic Park City home at the top of Main Street has been stolen. Pamela Dore Alford with PJ Builders said they suspect the sign was stolen this past weekend on the night of September 6th or 7th. Alford said the company has been on the property almost daily as it prepares to dismantle and rebuild the home, which dates back to the turn of the 20th century. Park City's Historic Preservation Board approved plans for the project in June. The new owner will deconstruct the building and salvage as much of its historic materials as possible before transforming it into a single-family home. PJ Builders owner Pete Olson said the theft is not just a loss to the new homeowners, but to the entire Park City community. Alford noted the blue sign above the main door, which reads "The Centennial" and stretches several feet wide, has been in place for more than 30 years, and bolt cutters were likely not needed to pry it off. Park City Museum records indicate the historic boarding house had a variety of owners during the 1900s. As ski bums came to town, it became a cheap place to stay and a hot spot for, quote, frequent and crazy parties. Alford said they have not filed a report with police as they hope to find the sign through grassroots efforts. Park City Municipal is aware of the situation and has reached out to PJ Builders, per a spokesperson. In other news, the Colville luxury golf resort Wahali says it needs $6 million in cash to restructure its debt amid Chapter 11 bankruptcy. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports creditors are trying to force resort owners to fast-track the process.
On a conference call with creditors September 11th, one of Wahali's managing and founding partners, John Kaiser, says the resort needs $6 million while it navigates bankruptcy. That's to pay for golf course operations, install water and electrical lines at the resort, and fulfill outstanding obligations to the city of Colville. Wahali has to finish a new sewer pump station for the city on the west side of Interstate 80. Colville Mayor Mark Marsh says it's in the resort's own interest to finish the sewer infrastructure project.
It'll be pretty important for them to do it because if we can't handle their sewage, they can't build anything.
Kaiser proposes financing the operational costs with debtor in possession or DIP financing, a special type of loan that would allow Wahali to borrow money it needs to restructure. A DIP loan would need to be approved by a bankruptcy judge, and Wahali attorney Mark Rose says he'll make the application in a matter of days. Wahali filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy August 8th amid allegations it had defaulted on loans, owed money to contractors, and laid off all employees except those running its golf course. According to Colville's interim city attorney Craig Smith, there are currently about 40 employees still on the payroll. In a court hearing September 2nd, Rose said the resort didn't pay employees in June or August. People who had purchased lots in Wahali have since stepped in to fund payroll. Chapter 11 protections allow businesses to continue operating while they restructure their finances and make their lenders whole. However, attorney Michael Johnson, who represents Wahali's primary creditors, who say they're owed more than $85 million, has said he's not sure this is a reorganization. He has predicted the resort and golf course is headed for auction at what's called a Section 363 sale. Smith says Wahali isn't anywhere close to being sold yet and does not expect the bankruptcy to move quickly due to its financial complexity.
Over time, they'll either have a plan of reorganization approved or it will be converted to a Chapter 7, which means liquidation of all of the assets.
A local billionaire has already announced his interest in the resort if it's liquidated or sold. Doug Bergeron, who developed the Deer Valley Mansion featured in the Mountainhead film, wants to take over the golf course and build a hotel there. The primary lenders, meanwhile, want the process to move more quickly. They've asked bankruptcy court to treat Wahali as a single asset real estate debtor, which may allow them to foreclose more easily. Smith believes Wahali will likely oppose the motion. Its deadline to object is September 15th. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
KPCW's Christine Weller went to Park City High School to speak with social studies teacher Joanna Andres on becoming the 2026 Utah Teacher of the Year.
Good morning, I'm KPCW's Christine Weller, and I'm here with Park City High School social studies teacher, Joanna Andres. She was named Utah's 2026 Teacher of the Year. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, I appreciate it.
So I wanted to start off with, how did it feel to earn this title?
It was a big shock. It was huge. The other four finalists are a force to be reckoned with. They're pretty incredible. One of them is teaches students essential elements, which is severe special education. And she organizes a GoFundMe where she takes her, so she can take her students on field trips. Another finalist teaches AP US history and Chinese and organizes a Chinese New Year's festival. Another one teaches at a Title I school and teaches kindergartners, and she speaks Spanish with them a good portion of the day. And another finalist teaches college students at USU and second graders. So it was such a diverse group of people, and they have such an incredible skill set in their own, you know, in their own little section of the educational universe. And I didn't see it coming. I really didn't. I didn't think it was going to be me this time. And I was happy with that because I've never liked a group of people so quickly in my entire life. Like, they're great people.
Talk a little bit about the process, because it sounds like you met everybody, and I know there was also a 15-person committee yep. selecting the winner. So talk a little bit about the process.
Yeah, that was a learning experience. So initially, well, each school district and charter, and you can even nominate yourself, not puts forward a name. And then once they put forward that name, the 15 committee members you're invited, well, actually back up, before you get to the 15 committee members, you fill out an application and you write a series of essays. I believe it was 5 different essays. You get letters of recommendation. You do a headshot, all kind of, a lot of paperwork associated with it. And then you submit your entire package to be considered. And then that is given to the committee and they deliberate over that for weeks. And then you are notified, you get an email if you were not selected, and then if you are one of the 5 finalists, you get a phone call. And I got a phone call, and it was actually 24 hours after I was supposed to get the phone call. So I was already like, oh, well, I didn't get the phone call. It wasn't me. And I was at the grocery store, I was at Smith's, and I got a phone call from Katie Jones and Elijah Whitaker over at Utah State Board of Education. And then once that was over, the 5 of us convened at the Utah State Board office, and we spent a whole day together, which was really cool. Just kind of getting to know one another, talking about what it means to be a teacher leader in the state of Utah and in the profession in general. And then we prepared for our interview. So the interview was the following day, and we each had to prepare an opening statement of 5 to 7 minutes. Talking about illustrating how we teach with passion and inspire future generations. Then there was a kind of a rapid fire Q&A where they give you different scenarios and ask you, what would you do in this scenario or this? And then 6 traditional interview questions. And then the committee deliberates for a little while after, and they made the decision that day, and it was in August, but we didn't find out until September 4th. Wow. So, yeah, and then September 4th, we spent the day together again and worked with, spent with the other teacher leader cohort, all the other nominees. So it was a fun day.
That sounds awesome. Can you talk a little bit about, I'm wondering if you can expand on that question. Why are you teaching? What is your passion with it? Mm-hmm. And kind of what's your teaching style?
My class is very collaborative in nature. I'm very rarely in front of the class. I'm moving around. The students are grouped into groups of 4 or 5. They work in teams. They hold each other accountable, and they acquire and they earn professionalism and participation points throughout the class period. And at the end, there are certain benefits at the end of the quarter that they enjoy if they are their team or their class wins. So they're competing in multiple ways. For me, my class serves a pretty big purpose, and that is to allow students to engage and discuss what's happening in their government and in politics, especially if they disagree with one another. It's a place for them to deliberate, disagree, and learn how to do that in a respectful way. I just listened to an interesting podcast the other day. Amy Coney Barrett was interviewed, one of our Supreme Court justices, and she used to be a clerk for Antonin Scalia when he was still alive. And she talked about how impressed she was with his relationship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and how different, like ideologically they were like opposite ends of the spectrum, but they were still really close friends. And I found a picture of them online. They used to dress up in costumes together and go on trips together. And I printed it out and I framed it in my room because that's a reminder for them that that's your job. You're gonna hear different things. It's okay to be uncomfortable. It's okay to hear different ideas. But at the end of the day, what you need to do is be able to realize what you have in common is your humanity and your constitution. And so that's the room where they can do that, and it's a safe place to do that.
Right. And I know that you didn't originally want to be a teacher. Your
law. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about why you ended up teaching.
I think I went this route because it's more positive, it's more fun, and I think it's more impactful in a positive way. And I think I would rather spend my days hanging out with them than adults. No offense to anyone who's listening. But I mean, there's a certain level of, there's a willingness to learn from others that maybe when adults reach a certain stage, maybe there's a lack of willingness or a little more stubborn. And I think students are willing to learn from one another and willing to discuss things. And they're just kind. Yeah, they're really kind, and I enjoy spending my days with them.
I also wanted to ask about more of the, because you talked a lot about how these students are interacting with each other, what's going on in the classroom, but you've also seen really great scores for the students. Mm-hmm. You teach AP government. Mm-hmm. Do you teach any other AP classes?
No, AP government and criminal law.
Okay. And that those AP classes, students have been performing really well under your instruction. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think as an institution, our pass rate was 87% for AP. I know AP US History was 96. He'll probably get mad if I say 96.4. World History was 90%. AP Econ was 88%. And I was inspired by them. We learn from each other, and I think that our scores are where they are because we work together within our AP professional learning community to make sure that we are inspiring students, empowering students, and enabling them to learn the curriculum and apply it according to the College Board requirements. But I think I would not have the scores that I have, which aren't even as good as the 96.4 or anything like that. I think I would not have the scores that I have if it were not for my colleagues who are also pretty incredible and who have set records this year. And that's why we're at 87%.
Yeah. So now that you're a Utah Teacher of the Year, there are other things coming up for you. Tell us what's next in that process.
So as the 2026 Utah Teacher of the Year, it is you are responsible and you are privileged to fulfill a year of service. So for me, what I would like that year of service to look like, I would like to go to school districts throughout the state. Start with mine. I want to start with my district and celebrate and honor people who are teacher leaders in our building. Like I said, those AP scores are pretty incredible and they are inspiring others to rise above and elevate their students. So I want to celebrate the teacher leaders in our building, and I want to go into other schools and other school districts and celebrate other teacher leaders throughout the state. And I would really like to invite other members of the Utah State Board to join me when I am on those adventures. And I would like to invite legislators to come with me so that they can see just what teachers do in the classroom and how, not just how hard they work, but how they lead and inspire students.
Okay. Is there anything else you think we should know?
I think from this position, and I don't think there's a thirst for positive recognition within our profession. I think sometimes people feel, I wouldn't even say underappreciated, just unrealized. I think sometimes there's a tendency to make assumptions about this profession and what people do. I think there are misunderstandings, and I want people, the community here and throughout the state and throughout the country, to realize that we're all coming from the same place. We want what's best for students. Students are at the center all the time. And I want them to see and appreciate what I see and appreciate within my profession and with my colleagues, because they're incredible. And I have never in my entire career worked with teachers, and I'm biased, I work in this building, but I've also met with teachers in this state. I've never encountered teachers who work so hard and are so creative and dedicated to what they do. And it's a real honor to be part of that. So I want to highlight that throughout this next year.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Park City High School Social Studies teacher Joanna Andrus. She's the 2026 Utah Teacher of the Year.
Now joined over the phone by Brenda Bushell with the U.S. Forest Service. How's it going today?
Good. How are you, Parker?
I'm great. We're having you on to update us on the Beulah Fire, which sparked in Summit County last month. I guess just to start, maybe for people who haven't been plugged in as much, can you remind us where the location of this fire is?
So the Beulah Fire is north of the Camas Park City area, closer to the Evanston side. It is south off of the North Slope Road, which goes all the way across from Highway 150 that comes out of Camas all the way over to almost Flaming Gorge. It's a huge recreation area, and that's about the vicinity, so it's 30 miles south of Evanston.
Yeah. And so what's the latest status on it as of today? I mean, it seems like things have been trending in the right direction.
Yes, we have gotten a lot of moisture. Thursday, the Type 3 team turned the fire over to a Type 4 team and back to the district. And we're at 5,719 acres with 96% completed. We are also minimizing the closure that started today, which is a good thing. It opened up a lot more area for recreationists to get back in and enjoy the forest.
Yeah, in terms of closures, just in terms of what the fire impacted and what shut down, what are we looking at in terms of reopenings?
So as of this morning, the North Slope Road is now accessible. The Christmas Meadows area and the East Fork of the Blacks Fork are all open back up to the public. The East Fork of the Bear and the West Fork of the Blacks Fork and the area in between is still closed. And that's the actual footprint of where the fire burned. That area will still be closed for a while. We do still have firefighters in the area that are monitoring that. So we ask the public, if they are up in that area, to still be really cautious because we do have firefighters still on the roads and in the area.
Yeah, and can you talk about, like, the staffing on scene right now compared to the peak? And, like, as you referenced earlier, it recently returned to the Type 4 district team. Can you talk about the significance of that?
So, and I was trying to think, at the peak, I think they had as many as 700 on scene that was supporting the fire. We're down to... On Thursday, there was still about 120. I think we're down to about 40 right now.
Okay.
So as we get the completed percentage up and we feel more comfortable, the numbers go down so people can help support other fires across the country. And now the locals will continue to do work along the area and still keep an eye because there is still some hot spots in this fire that will probably be there until we get a season ending. Like a snowstorm, the rain has helped, but we're still not to that season ending yet. So we will still have crews there to monitor those hot spots.
Yeah, you mentioned some of the weather factors earlier. Can you What were sort of the key factors towards containing this blaze?
Water. The rain has helped immensely. And then in some spots, the fire has hit a previous burn that was up in that area that slowed it down due to the fact that there was not as much fuel to burn where it had burned several years ago. So that helped us as well. But the moisture, the cooler temperatures at night, and the humidity from the rain helped quite a bit to slow this fire down.
Yeah, and when it was at that peak staffing of around 700, what were most of those crews sort of doing on the ground?
So with a fire that is mostly in the wilderness, we do fight the fire different than if we can actively suppress the fire on its edge. So when you see a lot of the fires locally that you can pull a fire truck to, we're fighting with water, or you can get firefighters there to actively engage in the actual fire. In this wilderness fire, we couldn't do that. A lot of the resources were air support, dropping water on the fire as it moved. And so the firefighters on this fire were doing a lot of prep work, and they were chipping dead trees, clearing dead to give us a better fuel break on the roads. They were looking at the structures we had in and around the fire to reduce fuel around that. So if the fire did happen to move, we had a better plan in place. So it was a lot of prep work for the firefighters in case something, if we had a wind event and the fire decided to move, there was a lot of prep work versus a lot of work right next to the fire line. And that's where we get the difference of containment and completed, which makes it confuses the general public.
Yeah.
But that's more the difference that we are securing the fire line versus working towards objections and accomplishments on the ground outside of the fire.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, and just to transition, I was going to ask, what are kind of the finishing steps to, you know, sort of completing this wildfire, if you could say?
So there is still a hand line that was placed that they are working at pulling back in and getting put away. They'll just continue to watch a couple of those hot spots and just make sure that they don't move on us. And just a lot of it is going to be patrolling right now and monitoring what we have left.
Any worries about burn scars in those, any particular areas?
There is. And we do have, and I'm going to have to look up the, what the, we use so many acronyms, and then when we have to stop and tell you what the acronyms mean, we have, it's called a bear team. And what they do is they come in and assess what future things we need to do for that burn scar. So we've had crews going back in. We did have some dozer line outside of the wilderness for a fuel break. So we have crews go back in and they rehab those dozer lines. So they're putting dirt back over them. They're putting trees back over them, brush. So hopefully we don't have a lot of erosion in those areas. So this team will come back in and assess all of that. And then in this, probably next year, as we move forward, there will be a lot of work done to help prevent some of that.
Yeah, and then, I mean, just separately, how does the Forest Service feel about wildfire conditions, you know, for the remainder of the year until the snow comes?
We are still on alert. The moisture we've received in the last month has helped immensely. Our fire danger has dropped to moderate. We were able to lift the fire restrictions so people can go and have their campfires. But we're still watching the areas. In the last couple of years, we have had fires that started later in the season than what we normally expect. And we are still watching that. We still take fuel moistures so that we know where that line is so we can be prepared. Because we really could still have fires for the next month to month and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still watching everything and keeping our head on a swivel so that we know and are prepared in case we get another one.
Yeah, I appreciate the updates, Brenda. Is there anything else you want the public to know?
Just be safe out there. Make sure if you do have a campfire, please put it out. We have a lot of campfires that people leave and they're still burning, and that's where we get wildfires. So just be cautious, have your campfire, enjoy it, but completely put it out. Use a lot of water, drown it.
Yeah.
Just to alleviate that from us and enjoy. And if you do recreate on that North Slope Road where we have firefighters, slow down, be aware that they are out there.
All right. Appreciate your time today. Have a good one.
Thanks, Parker. You too.
Well, over 24 artists will gather at the Kimball Arts Center Saturday for the 9th annual Monster Drawing Rally. The live drawing event is a partnership between the Arts Council of Park City and Summit County and the Kimball Arts Center. Spectators can buy a ticket to watch the drawing competition and see local artists' creative processes. Participants could even take home a new piece of art to add to their collections. The event begins at 3 p.m. Kids 5 and under are free. Well, I'm now joined in studio by Bruce Wardle with the Wasatch Community Foundation. Good morning. How are you today?
I'm very good. Thanks, Parker. How are you?
Great. We're having you on. You all are celebrating your 25th anniversary later this month. Anything you can share on the origin story of the Wasatch Community Foundation?
I'd be happy to, because it is a special occasion for us. We do an annual fundraising dinner, Parker, but this year we decided to focus a little bit less on raising more money and instead celebrating the achievements of our first 25 years. So back in the year 2000, a group of really great volunteers formed the Wasatch Community Foundation to connect residences and businesses who were able to give with other residents and businesses who were in need. So the organization was really founded from the community for the community. But today our foundation is one of the most active volunteer-based nonprofits in the entire Heber Valley, perhaps the Wasatch Beck, for the simple reason that we have a vast number of projects that we work on, which are all vetted and very volunteer-driven. It makes it easy for people who want to contribute and donate to know that the money that they are contributing and donating to us is going to worthy projects that have been vetted and that have a proven track record of doing good in our community.
Yeah, and tell us about this 25th anniversary celebration coming up on the 25th of September at Midway Town Hall.
Yes, it is, and we are excited about it because we focus at this celebration on all things Heber Valley. And so we have some great food. We're going to serve dinner first. Food is coming from a local Midway caterer and restaurateur, Hidden Valley Provisions. They have a nice little shop right across the street from the new Ballerina Farms and near the town hall. And then after a good dinner where we'll have food stations around and allow people to mix and mingle and to take a look at some of the work of our various pillars, which are actually our committees, the five committees that serve the community, then we have a local entertainer. Alicia Stockman is a singer and a songwriter. You probably play her music here at KPCW, and she's going to be performing with her band for the second hour, so it's a dinner and a concert. And Alicia let us know this week that she's graciously donating proceeds from her birthday backyard concert series to the Wasatch Community Foundation so that we can ramp up our music scholarships in the Valley as well. So we're very excited to have her. We also have a silent auction that will take place with local restaurants and services and hospitality companies, hotels and bed and breakfasts who have donated to us. And so the silent auction will be a nice part of the anniversary event as well. We just hope everybody has a great and wonderful time. And we're not totally focused on raising a ton of money this year, but more to celebrate the 25 years of our work.
Yeah, for those interested, where can they get tickets?
They're available on the website, which is www.rwcf.org. And it's the first screen that pops up. And I'd also share with you that for those of you who would like to attend and perhaps find the cost a bit prohibitive, we can give you a special discount code, WCF25, and drops the price way down to a wonderful $0 if you are interested in attending and having a good dinner and a good concert.
Yeah, separately, tell us about some of the recent work of your various committees at the foundation.
Well, you know, we cultivate partnerships with nonprofits in the area, in the Heber Valley and the Wasatch Beck, and make contributions and donations and grants to allow them to do more. So we don't get a lot of publicity at the Wasatch Community Foundation because we don't want our name out there and up front, and we aren't really the originators of the projects or the service initiatives. We find organizations that are already in play, doing great work, that are vetted, that are also 501c3s or c6s, and we donate money to them to allow them to do more. And so I mentioned earlier we have five community wellness pillars, which are entities that work in the Heber Valley, and we seek to meet people where they are and strive to unite community resources and programs with these five pillars, which are our committees. And some of the current projects, I'll tell you first about the two that I work on. I work on the Arts Committee and on the Education Committee. And I'm excited about the Arts Committee because, as you know, there are so many arts organizations and art entities in the Wasatch Back here in Park City and in the Heber Valley. I was thinking about this today. There are 4 performing arts theaters alone. There's the Charitable Acts Theater, there's the High Valley Arts Theater, there's the Midway Playhouse, there's the Timpanogos Valley Theater, and they all do terrific work. And likewise, there are numerous other arts organizations that are all part of the Wasatch County Arts Council. But the recent arts showcase that we did was to encourage unity and correlation and cooperation among the various arts groups. And as I mentioned, we support the Wasatch County Arts Council in their initiatives to bring coordination to all of those. Our chair, Mindy McMaster, is an incredible choreographer and dance artist. And so we have been having a focus with Mindy McMaster on dance and art scholarships. In fact, I'll tell you, Mindy is working right now with my sister-in-law, Laura Wardle, to produce dance-heavy musical coming up. The High School Musical will be presented at the Midway Town Hall in October. And it's going to be a terrific event because it's using a large number of high school age dancers and singers and performers, a super high energy stage adaptation of the hit Disney movie. So I'll mention the show run October 3 to 11 at the Midway Town Hall, and tickets can be purchased through the Charitable Acts Theater organization on their website, which is HeberCAT.org. And that supports a great cause because the Midway Playhouse is a new nonprofit youth theater company in the Heber Valley, and Charitable Acts Theater donates all of their proceeds from ticket sales back to the Wasatch Community Foundation.
That's great. Everybody loves High School Musical.
It's a great show. It's lots of fun dancing and singing.
Classic.
So I mentioned that, but I want to give a shout out to some of the great work that Tim Ricks has done through our Recreation Committee. One of the projects that's highly visible right now being built across the street from the new high school under construction and the Mountainland Technical College under construction is a new pump track in Southfield Park in Heber, west of the pickleball courts. And this project was led by the Wasatch Trails Foundation and also a big coalition of nonprofits and Wasatch County businesses, such as Gravity Coalition in Midway, owned by my friend Jenny, and many other businesses. But the pump track in Southfield Park will be a great new feature and get lots of use, I'm sure, next spring when it opens up.
Pump track is very popular here in Park City, so I'm sure that will be the same over there. I know we are a bit a ways out from Thanksgiving, but did want to have you mentioned the annual dinner you all are hosting.
That's probably one of the best events that the health committee, the health pillar or health committee, does for us on an annual basis. The health committee at the Wasatch Community Foundation supports healthy lifestyles and living and brings people together by promoting health education and health services. We work really closely with community partners and service agencies and healthcare organizations. John L. Fitzgerald is our chair of this committee, and in fact, for her profession, is a leader in the Wasatch Community Health Department. So that annual Thanksgiving dinner this year will be a free celebration featuring belonging and connection. It's going to be held this year at the Timp Middle School in Wasatch County on Saturday, November the 22nd. And our goal for this community dinner, we served hundreds and hundreds of meals last year, is to bring community connectedness, and a really important goal is to combat isolation. So we want to help people who are feeling a bit more isolated, who maybe don't have a large family gathering to attend for Thanksgiving, to come out and feel part of the community and feel the love. And we're going to foster community connectedness and combat isolation. And all the food, the turkey, all the Thanksgiving goodies that go along with that will be provided by the Wasatch Community Foundation, and we anticipate anywhere from 500 to 700 people come and have dinner that evening with us.
We're about out of time, but is there anything else you want to mention, Bruce?
You know, I would mention one more thing that I love dearly, and that's on the education pillar. We've been doing a lot of work in both the Lifelong Learning Project to focus on early childhood programs and special need programs, and on also a program called Step Up. Step Up programs is where the majority of our funding, and it supports multicultural experiences for families and makes sure that basic needs are met so that they can learn and be healthy in a position to learn throughout the day. But one more program that we work closely with is the UVU Wasatch Campus Woodbury School Hospitality Management Program. I don't know that many people realize that UVU Wasatch Campus has a Bachelor of Science in Hospitality Management degree, and I sit on the council there with many of the hospitality companies, all the great hotels of Park City, Summit County, and Wasatch County have representatives, usually their general manager or their HR manager, that sit on this council to produce great results in our hospitality management degree. So our program, right along with UNLV in Las Vegas, is one of the highest rated hospitality management degree programs in the Western United States. And if anyone in the area is interested in a fantastic career path in the hospitality community and the many tracks that you could get into, including ski resort management in the hospitality community, I would strongly encourage you to take a look at the UVU Wasatch Woodbury School program. It's really terrific.
We've been speaking with Bruce Wardle from the Wasatch Community Foundation. Appreciate you coming in studio today. Take care.
Thank you.
I'm now joined in studio by KPCW Development Director Sarah Irvin. Happy Friday, Sarah.
Good morning, Parker. Thank you for having me.
Yesterday wrapped up the on-air portion of our summer pledge drive. How did things go?
You know, we are feeling really strong. We wrapped up yesterday at 6 p.m. with the annual Rotary Rally, and that's always a fun way to wrap up our summer pledge drive with the on-air portion, with the three local Rotary clubs here in Park City competing for that coveted trophy. I'll give a quick update in case any Rotarians are listening. It looks like as of now, Noon Rotary is in the lead as far as dollars raised, but Twilight Rotary, the small but mighty club in town with only 30 members, has somehow rallied 55 donations so far. So they are certainly in the lead as far as per capita donations go. And but all in all, we are feeling tremendously grateful at this moment. We set out this week to raise $350,000. And anything that we raise beyond that will go immediately towards filling that gap left by the loss of our annual grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which, you know, as listeners know, has been eliminated. And that left us with a $264,000 gap as well. So we had budgeted to raise at least $350,000 this week, and we're on track there. But folks can still give. So if you haven't had a chance yet to make a donation, we are still accepting donations online through Sunday that will count towards that summer fundraising goal.
You mentioned that 246, I believe that's the number, $1,000 gap. I've been asked pretty consistently left or right, you know, I think the cuts have been out in the public very well understood. What does that represent in terms of our overall budget?
So for us, it's about 15% of our operating budget was in the form of that annual federal grant. So we're having to adjust. We're certainly trying to fundraise to fill that gap. But we're also looking at, you know, what can we do internally in terms of some budget savings in the immediate term. And then of course, looking ahead, that money is something that we had foreseen receiving for years to come. And so certainly making budget adjustments in the year ahead to adjust to the new reality of no federal funding. You know, and we hear from a lot of listeners that say, listen, I'm okay with the decision at the federal level that, you know, taxpayer support doesn't need to go to these media outlets anymore, but I will increase my support locally because I really believe in the services that KPCW provides, the local news, the public service announcements, the, you know, amplification of the work of nonprofits around town. So we're seeing that reflected in the way that local donors are, you know, continuing their support and in a lot of ways increasing their support. So again, we're tremendously grateful.
Yeah, can you talk about the team of volunteers that make the, you know, really on-air portion of the pledge drive possible?
Yeah, absolutely. We do have a really incredible group of volunteers who come in here for what feels like a million hours straight. I think it's, we have 48 active hours of fundraising that we do during these pledge drives, and we have volunteers come in for shifts ranging from 2 hours to, I think Bill Lassar was here for, you know, 8 hours each day along with Marlene Peacock. I mean, these are people that really dedicate a lot of time to the station, and they make a big difference for us because people call in throughout the week to make donations. It's fun to speak to, you know, friends and neighbors and people that they know around town and, you know, show their support for KPCW, but also really show their support for the nonprofit organizations that come in throughout the week. They're the ones on air that you heard Monday through Thursday, telling our listeners about the work that they do in the community and the partnership that they have with the radio station here, the way that we help get the word out. I mean, you know, we just had the Wasatch Community Foundation on talking about their upcoming fundraiser. This is the kind of work that we do all year long. And so during our pledge cycles, we do invite our local nonprofit partners to come on and tell that story and tell our listeners how KPCW helps them get the word out. And we also award them free underwriting for the money that they help raise for the station. And I'm thrilled to report that almost all of our nonprofit partners this week have hit their underwriting max, which is fantastic. If you didn't get a chance to give and you still want to attribute your donation to KPCW in honor of one of our nonprofit partners, there are still a couple that are right there, right on the bubble of reaching that maximum free underwriting. Would love to make a pitch for Park City Performing Arts. If you enjoyed their summer concert series and you're looking forward to their winter programming, we would love to give them that maximum free underwriting so you can attribute your donation to KPCW in honor of Park City Performing Arts. We'd love that.
Yeah, and why is underwriting useful for some of our local nonprofits?
Well, we've heard from a lot of our nonprofit partners that part of the real value that they derive of participating in the pledge drive is being able to earn that bank of credit that they can then use when they have upcoming events to promote or, you know, volunteer needs, new programs that they are rolling out in the community. It saves them marketing money. They don't need to spend money on advertising or underwriting here at the station. Of course, underwriting is the public radio term, the wonky term for advertising. But it's a great way for them to save that marketing budget and use it elsewhere. And we love being able to engage with those partners and help them get the word out with those radio spots that you'll start hearing from a lot of our summer pledge drive partners. They'll start using them right away.
Yeah. And, you know, when people donate, they often send in messages or kind of note what they really appreciate about the station. Any feedback that has stuck out to you?
Oh my gosh. Those messages are incredible. And it's been really fun to sort of, you know, hand them around the office and let folks be able to read the nice things that folks say. People said nice things about you, Parker.
Oh, that's, thank you.
But no, it's true. It's a great chance for our community to put into words what it is that they value about KPCW or write a nice message to the news team, to Leslie, to, you know, actually the behind the scenes folks get some shout outs too, which is great. The production and programming teams, our digital director, Matt Sampson, who's doing an incredible job of helping KPCW evolve and keep up with the times, right? We are obviously a public radio station, but we're so much more, and we really work hard to deliver our local news and our programming wherever anyone is. So whether that's on their mobile phones or checking their email inbox, you know, that daily newsletter, The Local, that's something that we're really proud of, and we are working hard to expand and deliver our services to everyone who lives in the Wasatch back or visits the Wasatch back or has any interest in what's happening in Summit and Wasatch counties.
You mentioned the pledge drive is running online through Sunday. Is that a, I assume that's easily accessible from the homepage of our website.
It absolutely is. There's a big, bright summer pledge drive button there. When you go to kpcw.org, you can click that summer pledge drive button or just click the donate button at the top right-hand corner of the page. And I did some quick numbers this morning. As of 8 a.m. this morning, we're looking at, we've had 945 total donations come in this pledge cycle. We are always working to cross that $1,000 donation mark. That would be 1,000 donations to the station. So what is that? We're looking at 55 more donations and we'd be there. So if you're one of the 55 folks out in the community who haven't yet had a chance to donate, we'd love to hear from you. You can donate online. And I'd quickly love to thank our sponsors, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. Deer Valley Resort came in as our first ever full day sponsor of the pledge drive. So many thanks to Deer Valley Resort, along with Columbus Pacific and Intermountain Healthcare, who were each full morning and full afternoon sponsors. And then, of course, thank you to Vail Resorts Epic Promise, Promontory Foundation, Iron Horse District, Albion Financial Group, The Yard, Crandall Capital, Sky Ridge Mountain Community, Monterey Technologies, Top of Maine, Park City Board of Realtors, and Roy Buchta came in as an individual member of the community sponsoring the pledge drive.
Very cool. We've got about 50 seconds, Sarah. Is there anything else you want to mention about Pledge Drive?
You know, folks can still get gifts when they donate. This is the only time of the year that we really offer like true gifts back out to the community is during our active pledge cycles. So if you make a donation online, you have the choice to ask for a thank you gift in return. These come from very generous local businesses, restaurant gift cards, single day ski lift tickets, activity passes, boutiques, nail salons, all kinds of things. So you can make a request for a gift as well when you donate.